Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. This is our third installment of our almost live coverage of the 4th International Paleontological Congress in Mendoza. So I say almost live because the whole world has been conspiring against the release of this episode. We had the big gala dinner to attend in a lovely vineyard in the Argentinian countryside, and then dodgy hotel and airport Wi-Fi has really hampered my efforts to upload it. So even though this is the coverage of the third day of the conference, the whole event is well over. Regardless, we got the usual collection of interviews featuring a very special guest at the end. You asked for him, we got him. As always, please share us with anyone you think might be interested, and we hope you enjoy this episode. So I've just been sat in the arthropod session here at IPC4, and I saw a talk by Vladimir Ivanov on fossilized stone flies, is that right?
No, caddis flies, Trichoptera.
What's the difference between a caddis fly and a stone fly?
Oh, these are quite different insects because caddis flies are holometabolous insects. They have larvae and pupae and adults, and stone flies are hemimetabolous. They have only larvae and adults without pupal stage, so these are very remote insect orders. But all of them are aquatic, of course, and they can be found near shores of streams or pools or something like this.
So the fossils you had, how old were they and how were they preserved?
Well, most of my fossils came from embers, and embers themselves are old as Cretaceous or later. Most of them are from Baltic embers, but also there are some fossil remains from Jurassic. This is middle of Mesozoic, and a few came from Paleozoic. These are stem group for caddis flies and Lepidoptera, butterflies and moths. And Paleozoic representatives are just a stem group for these two insect orders.
So they're quite a long-ranging group then?
Sure, they are very persistent, and caddis flies have some opportunities to be fossils because they are living near water, and fossils are very good as aquatic organisms. Aquatic organisms have more chances to be represented as fossils.
So one of the most interesting parts of your talk was where you had identified some drumming structures. Could you...
I have identified pheromone structures and drumming. These are two communicative possibilities for caddis flies to find each other. So drumming is just a part of their repertoire, and the other part are smells, volatiles. These volatiles are produced by pheromone glands and received by specialized sensilla on the antenna. And this pheromone information is used in line with the drumming. So these two modes are not exclusive, so they can be used simultaneously.
And so you found evidence that this kind of signaling was going on for quite a long time. It's not just the modern thing.
Yes, sure. We cannot find the signals themselves in fossil record, but we can find some structures that are useful for signaling. So studying these structures, we can decide if there was some sort of communication or not in the past. There are certain glands and associated cuticle structures, and there are some drumsticks on the abdomen. So these are direct evidence of existence of the communication in the past.
How important was this communication for them? Am I right in thinking that caddis flies only have a very short adult?
Well, this is a great problem for all insects because the world is too huge for them. Insects are tiny and the world is great, and they have problems to find each other in large spaces. So there should be some signals emitting from one insect to another one, to his countermate, to find mating pair. To find a female or male in a huge space. So they should use either dense populations when they're gathering together and just see each other Or they should have some long range distant calls, like international calls by phone. These long distance calls are performed mostly by pheromones, because pheromones are very persistent in nature and they can spread very wide outside the calling insect. And drumming are much shorter in their capabilities, because drumming signal is spreading only on the surface, and these insects should be on the same surface.
So how does the drumming work? Is it just purely a physical banging?
Imagine a woodpecker drumming with its beak on the tree. And if you have the ear on the tree surface, you can feel the vibrations. Of course, woodpecker produce also sounds, but the vibrational component is more principal for insects, because their hearing organs are on their legs in most species. There are some also songs by insects with other hearing organs on abdomen, on thorax, on other places, but most insects can hear with their legs. So this is our vibratory component is necessary, it's very principal for vibratory communication, and all these components are not audible, almost not audible for human ear. You must touch the ground to feel the vibration.
Okay, Vladimir, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm chatting with Alex Liu, who did a presentation at the conference this week about a pretty interesting new fossil that they found. What's the fossil called and what is it?
Hi, the fossil is called Hautia quadriformis, and it's what we think is one of the earliest fossils that has muscular tissue in the whole fossil record. We think it may be a cnidarian. And it's Ediacaran in age, which is why we think it's so important. Late Ediacaran, and comes from Newfoundland in Canada, and is about 560 million years old.
So this is before we start seeing hard parts in the fossil record. So how was it actually preserved?
So the fossil seems to be preserved in the same way as all the other members of Ediacaran biota in the same area, as a sort of cast or mould on a deep marine siltstone or mudstone, hemipelagite, and preserved by volcanic ash, which has come down through the water column and smothered the organisms and preserved them where they lived.
And what features of the fossil have led you to the conclusion that it did have muscles?
Well, it's very different to any of the other Ediacaran biota we've found from the region before. It has three main parts, I suppose. A basal large holdfast disc, which is anchoring it to the sediment. A short stalk, which is about 2 centimetres long, holding it up. And then it's got a sort of goblet-shaped body, which is made up of these fibrous ridges, and they seem to have a fourfold symmetrical pattern, which the ridges and fibres are all parallel to one another and run around the edge of this margins of this specimen, and then lead in each of the four corners. They lead up to bifurcating branches, which bifurcate and bifurcate again. And we think there's a sort of arm-like structures for catching food in the water column. But the fibres themselves are very distinctive and very unlike anything else we've seen in rocks of this age.
Do you have any idea why it might be that we've got this one example of the fossil and you don't really see anything else like it?
We have been looking for more specimens. We found this one in 2008. And we've been looking ever since for more, and found one more in 2013. So it does seem to be a very rare part of the assemblages. I mean, on the same bedding plane as the main one, we've got maybe 300 or 400 other fossils, all of the typical Ediacaran biota type, rangimorphs, the frondose forms, or just discs. So it just does seem to be very rare. We put it out there. We hope that it will encourage other people to find more specimens and look in their collections and localities to see if there's any other record of organisms of this type.
All right, well, thank you very much, Alex.
That's great. Thank you.
So I'm looking at the actualistic paleontology posters at the poster session today, and that's kind of experimental paleontology, and I'm here talking to Matt Davis. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Could you just give us a quick summary of the work that you actually did, or what your poster is about?
All right, well, this is work I've done with my co-author, Sylvia Pineda-Munoz, at the Smithsonian right now. And what we're basically looking at is we realize that Oftentimes, dietary proxies don't show the same diet for extinct animals. So isotopes may show him being an herbivore, whereas tooth morphology may show him being a carnivore. And we think that one reason for this is that diet changes over time. For example, on Thanksgiving, I would consume a lot of turkey, but on Halloween, I'd be eating a lot of candy. And the same is true for species in the wild. And so if you measure diet at different time periods or for different amount of times, you get a different diet. And what people don't realize a lot is that proxies average diet over different time spans. If you look at things like morphology or dental wear, they're averaging things over thousands or millions of years. So it gives you a very coarse signal of diet. Whereas certain isotopes may only record diet over a scale of weeks or months, maybe years at the most. And so comparing these different proxy records should give you different records of diet because they're both averaging diet over a different period of time. And so what we've shown using high-resolution data of different animals from very short time spans to very long time spans is that given different dietary proxies, they do show different diets, even though their diet we know to be the same.
So is this an issue that we can kind of solve when looking at these proxies? Can you separate them out and get that information separately to see what's going on kind of on different timescales?
If you can measure different proxies, it does give you a much richer view of diet because you can tell what something has eaten over millions of years versus just yesterday. And especially in conservation biology, they're doing this a lot with sampling things like feathers, hair, gut contents, blood, which all give you a different measure of diet over different time periods. And that can tell you things like what they ate during the winter versus the summer.
Okay, thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Andrzej Pacera, who has a poster here about sponges and whether or not we found a living fossil. The first question is, what is a living fossil? What does that mean?
Oh yes, it's such an informal but quite useful sentence showing that some still living animals have a very deep origin in time. That's some kind of an organism which survive for a very long time without much changes. That means they evolve, but very slowly, and recently living forms are quite similar to the fossil one. In this case, I compare recent sponge from around Madagascar, siliceous sponge, that is very similar to the sponge from the late Jurassic, which is 150 million years ago. So it's that's the definition. It's not exactly the same species, but the same genus. So closely related forms.
So you found that although the same species hadn't survived that whole entire time, it is still very similar.
Yes, that means that. But they are usually not the same species. It happens rarely. Typical examples were fishes called Latimeria, you know? It's not the same species which lived in the past, but those living today have many characters of their counterparts from the deep past from million years ago. And that's the case that I compared the skeletal structure of this Jurassic 150 million years old sponge with a recent sponge from the Madagascar, and they are very similar, and it allows to tell me that it's not the same species but the same genus. So it's a little higher taxonomically, but otherwise it's very, very similar.
And what kind of features do you compare in the two?
Yeah, it's for sponges it's very specific because often we compare some, you know, morphological types. Here is the most important is internal siliceous skeleton. Most sponges, not all, but most of them have skeleton built of silica spicules. So everybody knows about bud sponges, but these are not the same because bud sponges have no silica spicules. They have all organic skeleton. That's why we can use in a bath. This would be, you know, killing themselves because silica is very sharp. So I compare the characters, what kind of spicules consist of the geological sponge in the geological past and the recent sponge.
Why do you think that it has barely changed at all? Because other things seem to evolve very quickly. How has this managed to stay the same?
Oh, it's very difficult question. I cannot give it to you, but they are the oldest known metazoa. That means the first animals which have they are multicellular, and in theory, and probably because of this, you know, simple structure, They are well adapted, but there is no simple question. I cannot answer. I don't know that. If I knew, I would be, you know, well known why they survive. There's a general question for other living fossils. Sometimes it's told that other living fossils survive so long because they migrated to deep water. So maybe this is also the case, because both in the Jurassic it was probably some, you know, 200-300 meters deep, and this is also, you know, several hundred meters deep. Maybe this stable environment, when there is no influence from the surface deep marine, it helped. But it's just a speculation. You cannot prove anything like, because other deep water creatures evolve more rapidly. But, so the question is...
So that's a big question that's left.
Yes. It must be studied not just in sponges, it must be studied in and other animals, other organisms that survive for a long time without much changes. Because that's true that average rate of evolution is much higher, but in general, rate of evolution differs between different groups. And that's the problem for so-called molecular clock. Because first it was used, you know, stable rate of evolution for every group, and it gives the wrong result. Vertebrates evolve in a different pace than plants, and in invertebrates still different, and even between invertebrates there are groups which evolve very rapidly, and such groups in paleontology that evolve rapidly in the past, they are used as so-called stratigraphic fossils, that because they change rapidly with time, finding new forms allow us to date precisely the rock in which they occur. But with sponges it's just opposite. They didn't do this. They evolve slowly, so they are not good stratigraphical fossils or guide fossils, as we call it. It is just a nice object of investigation.
Okay, well, that was really interesting. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
So this should be an interesting one. We've come across the Brazilian paleocast.
Overseas, right?
Yeah, called Bone Collectors, but in Portuguese...
Colecionadores de Ossos.
So, tell us about Bone Collectors.
Okay, we try to do science, but in Portuguese, and talk about paleontology in Brazil. In fact, we have many channels. We have a website, a Facebook fan page, and a channel in YouTube. You can just look for it as Bone Collectors.
So what are you doing here at IPC?
Well, besides showing my doctorate research, we are presenting a work about how paleontology is perceived by the public in Brazil. So we did a couple of interviews, 100 of them. 500 of them, interviewing people about their concept of paleontology and about specific paleontology in Brazil, their knowledge of Brazilian paleontology. It was surprising because most of the people showed some degree of interest in paleontology. So their interest in the tema, they know this is relevant, somehow relevant for society, but we still need to reach them further in the team Brazilian paleontology. They still mention a lot of tree rexes and apatosaurs, and the Brazilian organisms still are out of focus. Our research on this was a bit, how do you say, tendentious, because it was based on internet interviews. So we got people that already have some kind of education, so they have access to internet. So we pretend to expand this to personal intervals to see how the other portion of society view of paleontology.
You have quite a varied society as well in Brazil, don't you? Compared to somewhere like the UK, where it's all relatively well off.
Yes. It's difficult to reach every strata of society. These interviews, we were able to get the attention of many young people, but most of the people I'm frustrated were from the populated areas, and also that had high education level. So we still need to reach those ones where the fossils are, so the lower strata level society, right? We don't find fossils in the big city nucleus.
So do you have things like natural history TV programs in Brazil?
Oh, definitely not. They try to introduce that on like Sunday shows, but they're really poor on science that. So, unfortunately, in Brazil, the only access that people has to real scientific journalism is through internet.
And then things like museums as well, surely.
We do, but in big cities where the fossils are not present. But we have like the National Museum of Rio de Janeiro, where most of the people interviewed that had already visited the museum mentioned to be there. And we have plenty Brazilian fossils present there. So that's a good result. But as you see, from the people that were interviewed, only 79% already visited the museum. I consider that low, because we consider every museum. So not only paleontology museum. And from this percentage, only 40% visit some museum with some kind of paleontological exhibition. So that's something that we believe it's not from the Brazilian culture to be visiting museums like in Argentina or maybe like in Europe. So we have to stimulate this behavior and people that are interested in science there.
And do you have any kind of paleontology in your national curriculum in schools?
Well, yes, that's the sad part. In the first part of Brazilian education, paleontology is always explored in the evolution. When you talk about evolution, when you talk about deep time, so paleontology is inserted in the curriculum of the youngs. But what we believe is a fault is that the professor don't know how to talk about it, so they exclude it from the classroom. So sometimes students don't know the concept of evolution or paleontology when they're asked about it, but they say that they had it in class. So it's interesting, there's something going wrong there.
And so is this where Bone Collectors is hoping to change things?
Well, definitely. We hope to just gather about a bunch of people that are really interested in science.
And for our Portuguese listeners, where can they find your website?
You can find it at www.colecionadoresdeossos.com.
And we'll put a link online.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm at the poster session with Luke Strutz. Could you just give us a quick summary of your poster?
Sure. So what I've been working on is looking at modern estuarine foraminifera as an analog for understanding foraminifera that we find in these sort of interior seas that cover Australia during both the Cretaceous period and the Permian period, essentially. So what I was interested in was we have these very distinct assemblages that occur in these fossil deposits in the Permian and Cretaceous in these interior seas that are sort of atypical of a fully marine setting. So sort of looking around for possible analogues, and estuaries sort of cropped up as a possible analogue to do that, you know, as a possible analogue for these particular foraminifera biotas that we find.
Okay, and when you're trying to make that comparison, what do you look for? Is it literally just matching species?
Well, this is largely done at either a generic level or looking at morphologies. But the thing that first stands out straight away is this idea that within these fossil deposits, we have a foraminifera biota that is dominated by what we call agglutinated foraminifera, which are these forms that actually, rather than precipitate, like precipitating calcium carbonate to form their test, they actually stick sort of sand grains all over the surface of their sort of a proteinaceous sheath they build around their cell. And when we find biotas that are dominated by those forms, there's really only two places they occur. They either occur in an estuarine, in the modern day, I should say, they either occur in an estuarine setting or they occur in the deep sea. And we know from sedimentological data that these deposits that are in these Cretaceous and Permian interior seas can't be deep sea. They must be shallow water. So firstly, that was the first thing that stands out straight away, that we just have this agglutinated dominated assemblage. And then secondly, then it starts to, yes, I went into detail looking at comparisons. And it's quite amazing, actually. You can actually make comparisons in some cases at the generic level. You can sort of look at these same genera are occurring over this sort of 270 million year span in essentially what appears to be, for all intents and purposes, the same environment.
And how do we know that it's actually kind of the same things living in the same environment and not just that they moved or could live in a different place?
Sure. So foraminifera are very characteristic in the sense that they are, when we look at modern foraminifera, they're confined to very specific sets of ecological conditions. They sort of occupy a very distinct niche, you know. And so an individual species will be confined to a very particular range of salinity, very particular range of oxygen conditions, pH, water depth, all these various, you know, hydrodynamic characters. So when we see foraminifera in the fossil record, we can interpret that in the same way. And we've done that certainly a lot. There's been a lot of work done, firstly establishing that and certainly and identifying that these particular foraminifera occupy estuarine settings. But also that has been pushed back into certainly the sort of sub-recent, if you will, sort of the shallow fossil record, looking at changes associated with sort of, say, anthropogenic activity and whatnot. And that seems to hold up very well. We also obviously use other sources of data, so we have sedimentological data and whatnot that we can use to sort of tie that all together as well. So it's pretty strong evidence that these things are living in a consistent environment through time.
And are there kind of broader implications to this work?
Sure, absolutely. So these interior seas that we've got, particularly so something like in the Cretaceous, for example, this is where a lot of sort of like marine reptile fossils are being recovered from, things like that. So any other organism that's inhabiting, obviously there's other invertebrates and things like that as well. So there's not a huge range of invertebrate fauna, I should say, in these deposits, particularly in the Cretaceous. And that's one of the reasons why foraminifera are sort of one of the, I guess, great tool for understanding these environments paleoecologically, because there's not a huge sort of invertebrate fauna in some cases in some of these deposits. But certainly anything that was living in these environments must have been living in what was essentially a marginal marine setting. Now, we can't say specifically what those conditions were in an absolute sense. We can talk about them in terms of relative to open ocean conditions. And that's sort of the part that I like make clear, I guess, and I'm sort of still sort of quantifying, I guess, is, you know, you've got to understand, you know, that it's what are open ocean conditions, then say, okay, well, it's probably a certain percentage lower than that, you know, in terms of, like, say, salinity. But yeah, so for example, you know, one of the more famous fossils, and I've put it on my poster here, is sort of this popularist thing to grab people as they come by, but is Chronosaurus queenslandicus. You know, it's a very famous fossil from Australia. That must have, it's recovered from within these interior seas in the Cretaceous. So it must have, at some stage, been living in these sort of estuarine-like settings. And I guess we have a modern analogue for that, something like a saltwater crocodile, whatnot, in Australia, a very large reptile living in an estuarine, shallow water condition. And these environments certainly would have probably been deeper than what we see in a modern estuary. They're probably about 30 to 40 metres deep, I would say, roughly, an estimate. It's quite plausible that the organism in question could have got into these seas, but it's living in a, yeah, marginal marine-style setting.
That was really interesting. Thanks very much for talking to me.
No problem.
So a man that we've been asked to interview by more than one person, and someone that we all should probably be very familiar with his work, is Gerard Vermeij. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to do it. Good morning.
So you've had a career looking at mollusks, is that right?
Those are the animals of first choice, but I've written and talked and thought a lot about everything else as well, plants, fish, crabs, you know, economics, oceanography, and so on. But yeah, mollusks are my first love.
So what is it about mollusks that you like?
Well, first and foremost, they're beautiful objects. You know, the shells are gorgeous. Secondly, they tell us a lot. You can analyze them functionally. You can look at shell repairs and other instances of damage, and you can do this in ancient mollusks, so you can have a window on the past.
Okay, so if we start right at the basic level, what defines a mollusk?
Well, of course, our technical definitions, they all have a mantle, a covering, which in many mollusks produces a shell. Besides that, there really isn't a whole lot that makes them a single unit, except we now know that they do form a single branch in the tree of life.
Okay, and what kind of environments do they occupy today?
They are essentially everywhere. Of course, primarily they're marine, but there are lots of freshwater ones, lots of terrestrial ones, everything from deserts to near polar regions, the deepest sea to the highest altitudes. They're just about everywhere.
So you got mollusks in the desert. Which kind of those?
You do. Those are land snails, which don't do very much. They just sort of sit there, and when it rains, they might mosey out and eat a lichen or two and then go back to hibernate or estivate, whatever you like.
Okay, so if we look into the fossil record, when do we first see any sign of any mollusks?
So the earliest definite ones are from the earliest Cambrian. There are debates about whether the Ediacaran fossil Kimberella is a mollusk. I am neutral about this one, but I am comfortable with an earliest Cambrian definitive mollusk.
So in the fossil record, the earliest Cambrian is really the first time, well, the Cambrian explosion is when we first get all of these sort of modern animal systems. So they've really been there since the get-go.
They've been there since the beginning of skeletons. There is actually a skeletonized tubular fossil called Claudina, which precedes the earliest shell-bearing mollusk by a few million years, but they're essentially there from the beginning.
And have they changed much throughout time?
Yes, they have, in all kinds of directions. The earliest mollusks, as far as we know at least, were relatively small, relatively sedentary. Now, of course, we have everything from fast squid to heavily armored snails to photosynthetic bivalves. We have, you know, an enormous diversity of habits, habitats, functions, and so on.
It's a wonderful group.
So in the first day of our coverage here at IPC4, we heard that gastropods just kind of cruise through mass extinctions without too much of an issue. And in fact, as we said, mollusks have been a constituent of many ecosystems since the early Cambrian. So what is it that makes them such survivors?
Well, I might actually quibble with the fact that they cruise through mass extinctions. I think if we look closely at all of the mass extinctions, an awful lot of groups did disappear. Many did survive, to be sure, but I don't think that snails, if you would ask the snail in the late Cretaceous, I think they'd be pretty worried. They are capable of many things. Many mollusks, for example, can shut down their metabolism reasonably well for a while. And I think that's a huge predisposition to be able to deal with mass extinction.
So, as we said, today we observe a great variety of mollusks in things like squid, slugs, clams, all of that lot. But in the fossil record, we only ever have access to their hard parts. So how much variation can be built into shells? Are we able to really identify each one as completely unique, or do we get a lot of kind of convergence in shell morphology?
Well, first of all, of course, there are occasionally soft body mollusks that are preserved, notably some squids and other cephalopods. But, shells are built on a very simple geometrical theme, the logarithmic spiral, where you grow at one end without radically changing shape. But within that confine, you have an enormous diversity of form, which becomes more complicated as the number of independent portions of the shell has increased over geological time. So, for example, early snail shells, you could describe with about three or four, what we call them, parameters or variables. Nowadays, in more modern groups of gastropods, you would have to have a few more parameters. So there are many more dimensions along which they can vary.
How much ecological information can we get from their shells? Can we learn much about the animal just from the, shell?
I think we can, at least within limits. You know, there are always some groups where you can't get very much information at all. But by looking at their shapes, at their exterior sculpture and many other features, we can learn about where they're living, how they're living, even, I think, how fast they can move, for example. And many mollusks are encrusted by other organisms, which tell you where they're living and where the mollusk was living. Many have repaired injuries, which are basically entries into the diary of life of a mollusk, these being traumatic events, surviving a predation attempt. So we can learn a tremendous amount by examining both the macroscopic features as well as the microscopic ones. You could look at shell structure and infer quite a lot from that as well.
Can we see mollusks adapting to any specific biotic and abiotic factors?
Well, like every other group of organisms, from plants and fungi to protists and bacteria, I would argue that mollusks are highly adapted to their enemies, whether they be competitors or predators or parasites. And so many of the attributes that we see and some of the attributes that change over geological time can be interpreted as adaptive responses to the changing landscape of enemies.
So is this your escalation theory?
That's the escalation idea. The idea that much of evolution, much of adaptive evolution, is dictated by the demands imposed by enemies, predators, competitors, and the like. So I think that there's a feedback here between enemies and their victims, where the enemies tend to have the upper hand. So much of what we see, I think, is dictated directly or indirectly by the activities and the capacities of enemies.
So is this one of the major driving forces of evolution, do you believe?
I would argue that it is. Other factors, of course, enable adaptation. This is very important to distinguish between enabling factors like temperature and salinity and so on, as compared to selective agencies or agents. So the first make adaptation possible and define the limits to which an organism can respond, and the second compel organisms to respond.
And how has this theory gone down? Is it generally accepted, or is this still a lot of debate?
You know, I'm probably not the right person to ask that question of. I would hope that people would find this acceptable. But I think there's a great deal of conservative, and I'll stop with that, thinking about how evolution works, or what selection is, or what the selective agencies are. I think it has gained wide acceptance. I think many people who might question it perhaps haven't, well, I'd have to say haven't thought it through sufficiently.
So what would happen in the case of an upset in this escalation theory? It's say like one of the competitors has just been taken out, mm-hmm. or there's been a change in environment right. that upsets the status quo.
Which happens, of course, during extinctions. Then, of course, the whole ecosystem is severely disrupted. We have to remember that, you know, mollusks, and like every other organism, are part of a large system. And that large system, the ecosystem, both sustains life, but also when it's disrupted, makes life very difficult. And so during mass extinctions, it tends to be the organisms with the highest metabolic rates, and therefore the greatest power, that suffer the most. And when you take those away, you're taking away major agents of selection for a little while. But as soon as recovery takes place, you reimpose that selection, and then you start the whole thing over again.
So the specialists are more likely to become extinct, and the generalists
I'm not sure I would want to use the terms specialist and generalist. I prefer to think of it in terms of power, where power is energy per unit time, or metabolic rate, which is the equivalent. And I think it's the organisms with the highest power that are the most vulnerable, but also, on the other hand, during other times, the most successful, or the most competitively capable. So that's how I would prefer to see it. You can find highly powerful specialists, but you can also find, as in the case of humans, highly powerful generalists.
Is it possible to try and estimate the power of extinct organisms?
I think that's one of the really major directions in which paleontology should go. We need to discover and to test proxies for metabolic rate. Now, the vertebrate people have become relatively successful in doing this because they can infer whether an organism is endothermic or ectothermic, warm-blooded or cold-blooded. We have some ways to go. I have various ideas about it, which I've published. For example, I think that we can argue that shell shape, especially the tightness of the logarithmic spiral, is an indication of power. But this idea needs to be tested. And I think for other organisms as well, we need to discover these fossilizable indicators of metabolic rate.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Well, I would have to say that for me, the study of the history of life and the study of beautiful objects, past and present, is continuing to be a most wonderful, fulfilling experience. And anyone who has a passion and a curiosity and the willingness to work hard on this stuff would be highly rewarded.
And would you mind if I asked how you examine fossils?
Well, I examine them by touch. I became blind very young. Well, I was never able to see very well, but formally I became totally blind at age 3. And so for me, the entire scientific enterprise has consisted of tactile and to some extent auditory sensation. I do an enormous amount of reading, of course, as well as original research, and so for me, examining fossils or living organisms, plants, everything else, is almost entirely by touch.
Do you feel in any way disabled when you're looking at mollusks, or do you not believe that you've been put in a disadvantage, so to say?
I think it would be foolish to say there are no disadvantages. On the other hand, you take advantage of what you have. And I think this is true for everybody. You know, everyone has shortcomings. And so the way of dealing with that is to do what you can do best and to know what you can do best. If people try to do the things that they think they should have to do but are not very good at, that's not a very good recipe for success.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.